from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. The sold-out Web 2.0 Summit began yesterday in San Francisco with much talk about paradigm shifts, social networking, and rapid changes in the whole world of connectivity. We'll sort it out with a panel and your calls and emails after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum. Web 2.0 is being heralded as a new and improved web, one that is all about connecting with people via interactive media, audio, video, and more. Instead of people connecting computers, computers are now being used to connect people. A sold-out summit on Web 2.0 began meeting yesterday in San Francisco, and we're going to find out what it's all about in this forum hour. And let me tell you who is joining us. Here in studio, we have Brad Stone with us, who is technology correspondent with the New York Times. Welcome, Brad.
Thank you.
Also, Sarah Lacey, author and columnist, bi-monthly Business Week column, Valley Girl, Business, Life, and Culture in the Silicon Valley. And she finished a book, in fact, on the rise of Web 2.0, published by Penguin, which will be released in May 2008. Still looking for a name. Welcome, Sarah Lacey.
Just not saying the name.
Oh, okay. Well, let me begin with you, and let's get a sense of what 2.0 is, because people can't seem to agree, frankly, on that, and there's even talk already about Web 3.0, so kind of ground us, if you would.
Yeah, whenever I tell people I'm writing a book about the rise of Web 2.0, I get one of two very tired jokes. One is, won't it be Web 3.0 by that point? Or one is, are you going to write about the fall as well? I mean, I think it depends on how you define it. For me, I define Web 2.0 companies as companies that entail social networking, social media, user-generated content, something where you're building a mass community that's enabling the sort of growth of your site, the spreading of your site, they're building your site, where the community is sort of this integral part of it. That, to me, is what Web 2.0 is about. If you
social networking is what we keep hearing. Then
yeah. But I mean, also user-generated kind of. You think of YouTube. I mean, YouTube is much more a user-generated content site than social networking. But ultimately, you've got sort of this rabidly loyal audience that's integral to this site being a success in any way, in a way that a web audience never was before. That, to me, is the shift. I think this summit has a really broader, different definition of Web 2.0 because, you know, you've got Ballmer speaking, you've got, you know, Meg Whitman speaking. They said there was going to be something on genomics yesterday. I mean, they sort of take that starting point and really run with it and extrapolate it out.
There are some people out there who may not know who Ballmer is.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Steve Ballmer of Microsoft we're talking about.
Well, it was funny. John Battelle, the sort of MC of the conference, was saying yesterday that people had wanted them to be a little bit more edgy and have developers and some of the trenches people. And he was like, so we've gone edgy with getting Steve Ballmer here. And I was like, what? Steve Ballmer's edgy?
Well, you mentioned Battelle. Actually, yesterday we saw Rupert Murdoch and Krista Wolf, who was the MySpace co-founder, on stage together talking with Battelle. And what seemed to come out of that, I guess, was no great surprise, but ties in with exactly what you say is this paradigm shift.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I think what people were really excited about yesterday is, to my knowledge, it was the first time that Mark Zuckerberg, the CEO of Facebook, and Murdoch and Chris of, you know, Fox and MySpace were at the same event together within a few hours. And, you know, certainly those are the two kingpins of Web 2.0, MySpace and Facebook. I mean, those are the companies that, you know, are really getting the super hyped up valuations. They're also the ones actually making the most money. And they're very, very different companies, even though they're both thought of as social networking companies. So I think the contrast visually to see Zuckerberg, and then seeing, you know, the much sort of smoother, flashier, LA-ified Krista Wolf really pointed out to people the contrast between those two.
LA-ified. I really like that neologism I've never heard before. But actually, you've said that Facebook and MySpace are more really business models. They're not competitors.
So yeah, I actually don't think they're I mean, they're competitors in the loose sense that, say, you know, the Fox Broadcasting Channel and CBS are competitors, but they have very different personalities. You know, they're both sites where you can connect with friends and there's sort of some loose things, but really, MySpace is a media property. It is all about cool. It is all about self-expression. The pages are a mess. People do whatever they want. That's what they love about it. It's all about, you know, music, bands. You know, you open the page and it's glaring music at you and flash ads are, you know, flying in your face and photos and all this. Facebook is never going to be that. Facebook wants to be the next sort of Google-like utility where you go to it to find anything you need in your world in one place. And it's a very different model.
Should Google be scared, really scared?
Well, no. not anytime soon.
And we're talking with Sarah Lacey, author and columnist, bi-monthly Business Week column, and Brad Stone's also with us. He's technology correspondent at New York Times, used to be with Newsweek. Let's plug your book, too. It's still out there, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a couple of years old.
But still extant.
Still on Amazon.
A book on robots, and the title is?
Gearheads.
Gearheads, yeah. What do you make of all this, Brad? Paul Bruton was saying that it's billed as, I'm talking about the conference now, Big Think Brainstorming Conference, and he said really what we have is a three-day business development party with people paying $3,000 as an entry fee. That's what it actually is.
I think that's right. I mean, us in the press, we don't have to pay anything. It's a great privilege, actually. I mean, you go for the people, you go for the conversations and some of the after parties. The content in the session itself is remarkable. Low calorie. You know, what passed for news yesterday was Mark Zuckerberg saying that he's close to closing a funding round, and Krista Wolf saying, the CEO of MySpace, saying that he's extending his tenure as CEO for another 2 years. I mean, stuff that probably make your listeners scratch their heads, but us, of course, in the technology world, you know, that...
You're jumping all over that, right? Yeah. But there's no real big thing here. I mean, you keep hearing about Web 2.0 as if it's some kind of colossal or major...
Well, I mean, we're into... Basically, what's the third year of the revival of the technology industry, and the changes are real and remarkable. I mean, you know, there's 1.3 billion people around the world connected to the internet, many with broadband internet connections. You know, online advertising is very real right now and supporting a lot of these businesses. And you know, the enthusiasm and involvement of people in Silicon Valley to develop these new kinds of companies and new innovations is real. And, you know, there's certainly some underlying stuff going on here.
Well, Facebook wants to be an operating system for the web. What does that mean? What is that going to mean?
Well, that's interesting. You know, here's what I think it means. The one kind of constant over the last 10 years has been surprise. You know, Microsoft was surprised by Netscape. Netscape was surprised by Yahoo. Yahoo was surprised by Google. Nobody knows what's coming next in this remarkable kind of shift to the internet. What Facebook is doing with its platform and inviting developers to come and create tools for the service is sort of inoculating itself against that change. They're saying, we don't know what's next. So we want, you know, all those innovators and entrepreneurs out there to come and develop for our service. And if they create the next big thing, it doesn't necessarily send people away from our site. They stay on Facebook and they use that great tool.
You're talking about all these shifts there. Some who are suggesting that Google may become the next Microsoft 2.0.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, our computing experience today is largely concentrated on the desktop, but what we're seeing is more and more of those tools gravitate towards the internet. We have word processors that don't sit on your computer. They're out in the internet, and people are using email services like Gmail and Yahoo Mail. The mail never reaches your desktop. It's all on the internet. And so that's a huge threat to Microsoft, and it's why Steve Ballmer and Bill Gates are kind of quickly retailering the company to create all those web services.
And what about the widgets we keep reading about, companies like Slide and RockYou and their
proliferating? It's just a terrible name.
It is a terrible name.
Widgets.
Tell us what they are.
Well, so, you know, part of this Web 2.0 phenomenon is a sort of intrinsic interlocking nature of all these services. You know, I can have a blog and have a YouTube video sitting on my blog. I can have a MySpace page and bring in some Flickr photos. There's a sort of, you know, interlocking nature to all these services. Well, a company that is creating a widget like Slide isn't necessarily drawing people to slide.com, although they have their page. So they're creating a tool, in this case, a photo sharing tool that Facebook users and MySpace users can import and bring onto their pages. Now, the problem with
that... So, excuse me, what does Slide do? What does the widget do?
Well, that particular... It's a slideshow. You can have 100 photos, and they cycle across in a slideshow way on your Facebook page.
It's kind of like a stock ticker. It's very glitzy. It's like blinging out your profile page or your blog or whatever.
Blinging. That's the use of a verb there, too.
The untested element here.
Spending my vocabulary use here.
The untested element is how these widget makers make any money, because they're essentially barnacles on the hulls of these large internet companies. And they're being valued very highly by investors, but that's sort of an unproven model.
I think the widget economy, as they call it, which gives the horrible term widget a little more gravitas, is the most sort of unproven aspect of Web 2.0. When you talk about Facebook or MySpace, these guys are actually doing a fairly good amount of revenue, and there's such a real internet advertising backbone now in this economy. But widgets are like, if you think about it, in a very short time, the internet has gone from, you know, these sort of gated CompuServe AOL communities and thinking no one would ever use a broad internet, to now we're to the extreme where people are taking these Lego chunks of the internet and creating their own internet, and a whole internet company can be built, you know, across all of these other properties. It's a pretty heady, crazy concept. And, you know, basically Slide and Rocky are both trying to beat, they're both trying to get to be bigger than Yahoo. They want to be the biggest site on the web without actually having their own site on the web.
Are they making money?
Very little. They're really, well, I mean, to be fair, they are just now starting to roll out their advertising programs and they're piloting it. So they've been very focused on building their audience to this point. So I think the next 6 months or so will be very pivotal to see whether or not advertising works in this model.
You know, this is shaking up the whole world of advertising potentially. I mean, with product placement and with user-generated kind of stuff, we're going to see a whole new Madison Avenue won't have the same meaning that it's always had, obviously. And investments, too. I mean, you can see actually unfurling in a lot of this, again, the changing nature of so many businesses potentially.
Mm-hmm. Well, one thing that's been fascinating to me, the communities and the audiences of these sites, you know, play such a huge role. And sometimes if they don't like where a site's going, they will like rise up, you know, in arms and demand that things be changed. And, you know, if Facebook, you know, gets to the point where it's a public company, which I think is further off than a lot of people want to think it is, it'll be very interesting to see how you manage a public company when you have sort of a massive community that aren't really your customers, aren't really your employees, or somewhere in between.
And you're thinking, for example, you want to sell a house. Why do you need to go to a real estate agent if you've got this kind of network out there? I mean, it changes so many paradigms that we're used to and that we're, I mean, just like journalism has been changed so much by blogging and all of that. How many blogs are out there now, by the way? Do we have any idea?
Many, many with one reader each.
But if you want numbers, 100 million a month go to MySpace. I mean, that just dwarfs about everything on the web.
One out of every four people in the U.S. has had a MySpace page.
Yeah, I was surprised when I mentioned a friend of mine who is a major technology company CEO. Said, do you want to be a friend on my? It was like the old Friendster thing, but, you know, you want to join him on MySpace. This is now what we're, some of us old-timers are facing.
Get with
as well.
The times, Michael.
Yeah, but all these new kind of applications over user-generated content, it's like we went from Wikipedia, now we go to MySpace and Facebook.
That's one remarkable thing that I think is not completely taken into account when investors are valuing these companies, and that's the fickleness of the audience. I mean, we've seen, particularly here in the Valley, move herd-like from Friendster to MySpace, now to Facebook.
Sort of LinkedIn in the middle.
Yeah,
and
with
now
LinkedIn,
the business.
And then there was a little flurry around a mobile social networking company called Twitter. And, you know, there isn't much cost for users to kind of moving around and trying out these new things. So when a company claims to have 100,000 visitors a month, that may be true today. It might not be true tomorrow.
So any idea either of you what the new big thing is going to be?
If we knew that, maybe we wouldn't be in the
You wouldn't be here. You'd be out there bringing in streams of revenue. But what about the impact, though, on established technologies and, for that matter, on IT managers? I mean, we're going to see some major impact, aren't we, with Web 2.0?
I think so. I mean, I think a lot of it has to do with what Brad was saying earlier about how much is moving from the desktop to the web. I mean, he was talking about a lot of the consumer services, which, you know, I put in that bucket also like Flickr and, you know, putting your home movies on different sites. I mean, your media all on the web so you can access it anywhere. If your computer crashes, you can still get to it. Same thing's happening with business. I mean, Salesforce.com was one of the few really exciting business software IPOs of the last couple years. And, you know, basically what they do is instead of an IT person getting this software, putting it on their, you know, databases, running it in-house, having to deal with it when it breaks, Salesforce runs all that for the companies, and they sort of rent the software over the web, you know, and they kind of use as much of it as they want. So they have none of the hassle of maintaining the hardware associated with it. Everything, I think, is in a real big trend towards going to the browser, and that's going to make life easier in a sense for IT managers. It's going to make life harder, too, because it's out of your control.
We're talking about Web 2.0 with Brad Stone and Sarah Lacy. Let me open the phone lines and invite those of you listening to join us. You're cordially invited to weigh in here on this whole new world of connectivity, or what seems like a whole new world of connectivity that's connected to Web 2.0. Our toll-free number for your calls is 866-733-6786. Again, that's toll-free, whether you're listening to us on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. You can join us now at 866-733-6786, or you can send an email to us, and the email is forum@kqed.org, the email address, I should say. And lots of talk about a bubble with all this. Let's get to that. We might as well.
So I have a very allergic and angry reaction when I hear that, mainly because I think there's this thing with the bubble where there's a sense of something feeling like a bubble, and I think these times feel like a bubble. To me, a bubble is a mass economic phenomenon. I mean, that's what happened in 99. There were mass public investors. You know, companies were going public. You had old line companies paying billions of dollars to acquire these companies. I mean, it permeated the entire U.S. economy. There was a huge mass feeling of, you know, a frenzy around the web. That's not happening this time. I mean, when you talk about big valuations, these are Silicon Valley insiders paying these big valuations. To date, YouTube is the only company in the scene that's had, you know, $1 billion-plus sort of event when Google bought it. So, and I don't know anyone who's planning to file to go public. So, you know, I think this wave of companies are very socially transformative based on what they're doing. I think that probably if you're talking about $1 billion-plus company, you maybe have Facebook, you maybe have LinkedIn, you'd have MySpace if they hadn't sold, and really, then you got a couple $100 million companies and a lot that are sub $100 million. So I think the talk of the bubble is the memory of the last time we got excited about the internet. I think it's a lot of parties and people start getting palpitations because the bust was so bad. I think if you look at the numbers, it's just purely a psychological reaction.
A lot of apprehension is
Yeah. I think, you know, something's happening here, and it may be a bubble. It just may be a matter of definition. But what we're seeing is sort of valuations and the logic behind them creeping up. You know, they have their own internal logic, but when you take a step back, it stops to make a lot of sense. So, you know, Facebook reportedly is about to close a round of financing that will value it at $15 billion, and you take a step back and you see that that's about half the value for Yahoo, a public company, with, you know, maybe one tenth, probably less, the revenues, a fraction of the employees, you know, a lot of questions about its future business model. You know, in private investment rounds, we see companies started by entrepreneurs with records of success, raising hundreds of millions of dollars before they even lay out a business model. I talked about a couple of them in my story yesterday about fears of this return to a bubble. You know, one is a company started by Marc Andreessen, the founder of Netscape, called Ning. It's a social networking company. It tries to develop social networks for anybody that wants them. And it was recently valued at $250 million, you know, on his name. And what's happening is that there's so much money in venture capital coffers that basically there's a lot of competition for these deals, and it drives the value up beyond.
And to me, that's the difference. What you had in the late 90s was you could flip a company and take it, you know, have it listed on NASDAQ in 18 months with no business model. And there was this idea that there was sort of this instant churning.
Remember pets.com.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And you had incubators that would, you know, well, we can just turn out .com and this and .com and this and .com and this. And that's not what's going on here. I totally agree with Brad. There are some crazy valuations. they're based on all the amount of venture capital that's still floating around the valley and is competing with each other to get in these deals. And, you know, if these companies all went under, I'm sure Brad and I would know a lot of people out of work. I'm sure maybe a lot of the listeners wouldn't. People outside San Francisco would have no idea that a quote-unquote bubble had popped.
There's one more thing driving this, and that's the fear among the four or five major internet companies like Google, Yahoo, and Microsoft, and eBay that they're going to miss the next big thing. And so they're bidding up these companies, the right to invest in them or the right to acquire them. You know, one example that I cited in my article yesterday was an advertising firm called Right Media, which was valued at about $200 million last October and then was purchased for $850 million by Yahoo about 6 months later. And it didn't quadruple its value, but it was, you know, it had the luxury of being the subject of a little bit of a bidding war. And it was acquired for a price that doesn't make a lot of sense.
Let's go to our calls. Mike in Mountain View, good morning.
Good morning. I had a question kind of going back to the IT managers discussion, which is what happens to hardware development if all this stuff has to be browser-based, where you store all of it, and what impact that have for, like, server farms?
Well, I think you've already been seeing that. I mean, one of the biggest sort of not sexy but underlying things in all this has been the rise of something called open source software, which is sort of cheap or free and built in this collaborative manner. And along with that, what they call sort of commodity hardware, which is sort of basically a fancy industry word for really cheap Dell server boxes that have, you know, and that those two things are a big reason why Sun Microsystems business has been in serious trouble. So, you know, I think ultimately you It's a lower price point of hardware, so there is some compression in the market. But ultimately, you still need all those servers and all that hardware to run it. You just have a company like Salesforce.com that's doing it versus, you know, say, KQED having to buy, you know, a bunch of servers and run it in-house.
Let me thank you for the call, Mike. And let's go to another caller here, Jeev, joining us. Good morning.
Hi, how's it going? I'm Gabe from San Francisco.
Gabe, excuse me. Go ahead.
No problem. I had a question for your speakers. I'm wondering if they could comment on sort of the security issues arising from, you know, the shift to open source and the shift to sort of the, you know, Web 2.0, Salesforce.com being a good example, right?
Yeah, a lot of concern about that, especially I was reading some stuff about, you know, medical data, and but security in general, IDs, identity. Brad?
Certainly. I mean, we're all taking a huge blind leap as we put our lives online, our private data, our emails, entrusting financial information, you know, not only to our banks, but to all these online retailers. And we're seeing again and again that you know, they're not always worthy of that trust. And the sort of maybe positive pattern that's been established is when there is a kind of crisis like TJ Maxx faced last year, where they exposed all their customer data to identity thieves, you know, reaction from state attorneys general, from the press, from customers is immediate. And I think companies know right now that, a part of doing business in this new connected age is to make their customer data secure. We haven't reached the point where, those kind of breaches sort of disappear.
We'll continue, by the way, with Brad Stone and Sarah Lacey. And Brad Stone is technology correspondent in the New York Times, and Sarah Lacey, author and columnist, bi-monthly Business Week column, Valley Girl, Business Life and Culture in the Silicon Valley. And your calls, again, if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-733-6786, or you can join us by email. Our email address, forum@kqed.org. You're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. And you're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking this hour about Web 2.0, the much-anticipated summit taking place in San Francisco with Everyone from Rupert Murdoch to the founder of Facebook on hand to cut deals and promote their vision for the web. And we're looking at social networking, widgets, and other emerging trends that make up the universe of Web 2.0. And here's a listener who says, please, there are those of us who don't even know what Web 1.0 is. Please ask your guests to describe what this means to us.
Well,
Brad Stone.
I think it means that the phone that you have now, which probably has a camera inside it, and the new 5-megapixel digital camera or video camera that you bought, that stuff doesn't necessarily need to sit there in the phone, in the camera, or in the family collection. That there are all these sites right now that want your participation, that you want you to come online and share all that material with your friends and forge online connections and to kind of transfer your life online. Now, you don't have to do that, but there are, a lot of people, particularly young people, who, they don't know any other way. And logging on and participating in that community is actually more appealing to them, tragically for us, than opening the New York Times or Business Week or turning on the TV at night.
But as I said in my introduction, I think one of the distinctions, I suppose, that maybe helps define 1.0 from 2.0 is that instead of connecting computers, you now have computers being used to connect people.
Yeah, and I mean, it's also in the first generation of web, companies were trying to get people to get online. We take the web so for granted today, but it wasn't that long ago that people had dial-up connections in their homes and people
connect
didn't
to
have
the superhighway.
Yeah, yeah, and people didn't really know what it was or what you could do. And so the first wave was all about sort of these big companies like New York Times, Business Week, Amazon, whoever, having all this content and things they wanted to sell you and kind of pushing it all to you. This generation of web companies are all about kind of giving you these tools so that you can interact with whoever you want and all of your friends. So, if you think about it less as sort of big companies pushing things to you and more, hey, here's a place where you and everyone you know can play, share photos, communicate, do whatever you want. That's what's sort of socially cool about these companies. Business-wise, big open question whether it's as profitable as the first wave.
And then we go to more calls. Shelley, join us. Good morning.
Good morning. I think that you may have answered this question in your last comment, and that was what's the difference between Web 2.0 and the ASP or application service providers of the prior to the dot-com bubble bursting, and that may be the last mile that there now is more access to high-speed Internet because Salesforce was around then. They survived. Most of the other application service providers did not. So, and certainly in terms of business applications, why do you think people will be more likely to use business applications web-based than they were then?
Well, I think if you look at what's happening on the consumer side of the web, a lot of things that are really starting to happen now were things that were kind of promised in the early days of the web. It just simply took this long for this many people to get online, for this many people to have high-speed connections, for people to feel very comfortable using the web, for businesses to feel very comfortable advertising on the web. So you're kind of seeing a lot of those early promises and hype that we all stopped believing in 2000 actually be true. I think when it comes to hosted business software, it's very much the same thing. I mean, I remember in sort of the 99-2000 days, that's when I moved here as a reporter, all these stories about these ASPs and these, huge server farms they were, and it was, they all went under and everyone was like, oh, that was ridiculous. And then you had, Larry Ellison, who's by far one of the most visionary people in business software, the CEO of Oracle, invest in two small companies, one being Salesforce, one being NetSuite, which has filed to go public and should be going out at some point. And sort of has the same model as Salesforce, but a different type of business software. He funded these two companies at a time when this model was thought to be dead, much like the consumer internet was thought to be dead. And I think it's the same thing with business. They had to get very comfortable with using the web. The technology had to catch up, the adoption. So I think that there have been real parallel paths between the two of those.
Brad Stone, want to add?
No, she got it.
Okay. Then let me thank the caller, and we'll get some more of your calls on here. Jack, good morning.
Hey, good morning. I've got three things I'd like to comment on. First of all, I'm what we call in Silicon Valley a serial entrepreneur and been involved in some of this stuff for quite a while. Web 2.0 started out as more of a technology concept, which was providing the automation in the browser to be able to make applications that look and feel like things that work on the desktop. And that was the techie point of view. From the venture capital point of view, it is the social networking concept. It's the idea of being able to create communities. And what I'd like to do is also give you what I think is a prediction of what happens in the next phase of Web 2.0, what I think Web 3.0 is going to be. What I think the next phase in 2.0 is actually going smaller rather than bigger, and that is more focused individual communities, which has often been, you know, the goal, or a lot of people's view of the Internet is more of that long-tail concept of people with more specialized interests finding their own personal community as opposed to monolithic organizations. And I think that what you see with Mark Andreessen and others, you know, Sampa.com and so forth, there are other companies moving in that direction. And I'd say that my prediction for Web 3.0 is an intelligent Internet. And this is where, instead of having information available to us, like everything that's at Wikipedia, where in order for me to learn something about how oil is converted into gasoline, I have to go to school effectively and study online, there will be tools that will remember my interests, the things that I've done before, information about me, and also the information and knowledge from other people, and guide me to conclusions much more rapidly, much easier, without me having to become an expert in the field, but knowledgeable enough to understand the outcome. And I think that's the next big thing that we're going to see sometime over the next 5 years.
Well, I just got an announcement. UC Berkeley is going more in terms of Internet and making things available like YouTube to students, lectures on YouTube. And I thank you, Jack, for the call. Actually, the real visionary here may have been Howard Rheingold in response to Jack's call. But social networking, let's talk about that, because that's kind of central to so much of what's going on around Web 2.0. And Wired Magazine, Brad, was saying that it's a feature, it's not a destination. You know, it's that first phase, it's not an endpoint, really.
You know, I think it's different things to different people. There are, you know, a lot of people that belong to MySpace and belong to Facebook whose primary activity is on those sites is approving their friends, and they don't do much else. To other people, it's kind of...
I was reading an article where a guy was saying, I spent hours and hours on it, and what did I get out of it? I haven't quite figured what, you know, that I can put my hands on. Yeah.
You know, to other people, it is their online experience. You know, I think it's kind of true value, you know, is a little untested at this point.
But is it a large-scale future, potentially?
I think there's something definitely inherently interesting about, you know, what Mark Zuckerberg sort of geekily calls the social graph. And that's, you know, the connections in the real world, the people we know, the friends, the colleagues and the acquaintances, and being able to translate that kind of world of connections online. And so, you know, if I'm announcing, you know, a new baby or my wedding or some big event in my life, it's how I kind of communicate to that group. And there's value in being able to touch all those people very easily and sort of in a frictionless way online.
I actually think it's very socially transformative. I mean, you know, for my book, I spent a lot of time talking to teenagers and college kids and getting a sense of how they use the web. I use all these sites and I feel like I use them a lot, but even I, you know, at 31, don't use the Internet the way someone who's 16 or 18 does. And for them, it's this sense of they never have to lose touch with anyone again. They never have to lose touch with brothers, friends who go to college, their friends who move away. I mean, it is this tightly, tightly wired world. And on Facebook, you go to the page, you see if your friend broke up with their boyfriend, you see whose birthday it is, you see everything that's going on. You know, I feel like when I was growing up, if one of my friends moved away, I had to make a serious effort and I'd be like, oh, we'll stay in touch. But I knew over time that would dissipate. It's really socially transformative to think if you want to stay in touch with anyone, you can, with a very minimum amount of effort, know everything's going on in their life and be, you know, just sort of a, you know, poke in the Facebook term is, you know, the thing when you kind of tap someone on the shoulder, someone can be a poke away. And you know, I think anyone who hasn't used social networking needs to get online and play around with it. It's kind of like TiVo or the iPod. These things that have been that you think, well, you know, I already watch a lot of TV. Why would I want TiVo? And when you start using it, you realize you watch TV very differently. I think social networking is something that people need to use to get it.
On we go to more calls. Drake, morning. You're on the air.
Yes, good morning. Thanks for the program. Just wanted to lob a definitional comment on a topic or string you guys were on a few minutes ago, and that's the topic of the bubble. I think we may be dealing definitionally because the last one, the 99 bubble, was sort of spilled over from Wall Street and Silicon Valley into Main Street, and this one perhaps hasn't made it to Main Street, doesn't mean it's not a bubble. It just may mean that it has a different focus. That's the first comment. The second is, when we stop making an investment and we start making bets, and by bet I mean we're not looking at 10x or 20x multiples on current cash. We're looking at 10,000 times multiple on potential next year revenues. We've lost all the basic mechanisms of prudent investing, and it in fact looks like a bet, which sounds like the underpinnings of a bubble. And then the third and final comment is, just because it's VC money and all insider money, as one of your guests commented, doesn't mean that this money is, one, stupid, and two, not ever going to look for an exit. So just because it's insider VC money doesn't mean that they're not going to want, again, a 10x return on their money, which looks very hard when you look at all the money that's going into these particular, you know, social network deals, for example. So I might just argue that while it may not be a national phenomenon a la 1999, it does not in any way mean that this isn't a bubble that's going to leave some carnage.
Thank you for that call. Sarah Lacey.
Yeah, I mean, I think you've got to keep in perspective what Silicon Valley is and what Silicon Valley does. And, you know, if we're going to talk about, you know, insider bubbles, look at what's going on with clean tech. The valuations are way higher. There's way more money going into it. It is unproven technology. It is an unproven market.
What is clean tech?
I'm sorry. It's sort of like green technology. It's sort of the catch-all for things that will...
Alternative energy.
Yeah, alternative energy, help the environment, you know... fast hybrid cars. It's kind of this huge catch-all. And it's way more money than Web 2.0. They're very experimental companies. They have higher valuations than Web 2.0 companies. I mean, so why isn't anyone jumping up and down about that bubble? I mean, I think there's something very emotional about the internet where people get upset. And I'm not trying to say it's dumb money, and I'm not trying to say they're not looking for an exit. But we have to realize what business venture capitalists are in. This is called risk capital for a reason. They are, in a sense, making bets on companies. That's what they do. They don't have a silver ball of what's going to happen. Google had no idea how it was going to make money, and there were a million other search engines at the time that Sequoia and Kleiner invested for a very, very high valuation. So, you know, this industry is always going to have huge waves where a handful of huge companies come out of it, and there's going to be a lot of carnage. I don't want to make light of that. I lived through the bust here, and it was very painful for me and many of my friends. Certainly Brad and I are in industries that are being collapsed by the internet, so I don't want to make light of it. I'm just saying, if you have an uncertainty with that, you shouldn't live in Silicon Valley, because that is the business of Silicon Valley, and it's not unique to this internet.
I do think one thing that's changed is during the first boom, a lot of, I would say, kind of traditional investors like university endowments, mutual funds realized that venture capital was an investment and could be a very profitable investment class, an alternative investment. And they decided they didn't want to be left out, and they started investing in venture capital funds. And what's happened really over the last 5 years is these venture capital firms have gotten a lot of extra poker chips. And of course, it is, you know, it's a gambling industry. But, you know, these, what we're seeing today are gambling valuations that have no association with the money that could be made by these companies. The hopes for a lot of startups is to be acquired by a Google or a Yahoo and a Microsoft. And sure, you know, mom and pop day traders might not be hurt if the bubble pops. But if you're a Yahoo investor or shareholder, you know, you have some questions about the kinds of companies, you know, that Yahoo is buying these days.
But there's still a lot of venture capital money out there. I mean,
the thing is, there was never the
Sand
shakeout.
Sand Hill Road is still green, not in the
right,
sense of
right,
the
right, not the trees.
Yeah.
There was never the shakeout in venture capital that there was in the rest of the startup economy. So that's the difference.
I think that's right. And let me go to some of your emails before I go to more of your calls. This is from Kevin, who says, "Hi, Michael. Would love it if you could quickly bring up the following 2 points. Seems that Web 2.0 conversations often center on social networking and video sites. The real deal, in my opinion, is Web 2.0 productivity online applications, particularly Google Apps for my domain. I'm a director of technology at an SF charter school, and we recently implemented this Web 2.0 solution for our staff and our students. Google Apps includes cutting-edge online productivity and collaboration applications like Google Docs, spreadsheets, and presentations, among others. Also rarely mentioned are free open-source Web 2.0 solutions that individuals or organizations can pretty easily install Web 2.0 websites and host their own, such as Wiki, Drupal, Plone, Moodle, so forth. Here's Mike in San Francisco. Says, I have two quick questions. Isn't Web 2.0 more than just social networking? It seems like all people talk about is kids finding friends. And two, isn't all this really just the beginning? New interactivity on the web is just being tested. So why would the companies that are successful today be the companies that will be successful in the future?
Well, that's a great point. I mean, as going back to an earlier point, there's a sort of inherent fickle nature to all this. But, you know, to the first emailer's point, you know, some of these online productivity tools, like those Google word processing applications, where you can be working on a document and have somebody else across the country seeing the changes you make in real time and making changes of their own. Mm-hmm. I mean, it seems sort of self-evident that you should be able to do that. But really, with Microsoft Word and before Word Perfect, you know, you couldn't do those kinds of things. And I mean, it's these kinds of tools are one of the things that have been fueling the productivity boom that's kind of behind the recent economic surge.
Now, always good to remind us of those kind of realizations. In fact, here's Jesse of Menlo Park, who says, in the internet since 95, a member of many startups, president of an open source software club, etc. Opinion of Web 2.0? Hype. Viable as a business? No. Products available at conference? Stayed path of development. If someone says absolutely great, look for the salt. All right.
Well, MySpace did. They didn't. Rupert did announce yesterday that they have $1 billion.
You're on a first name basis.
Well, you know, in my head, you know, that there's $1 billion of revenue at MySpace with $300 million of profit. So there's some business there, clearly.
And we'll have some more callers. Oshana, good morning.
Good morning. Hi, Michael. Great program. Great speakers. I'm a physician. I would like to bring the Web 2.0 focus to the Health 2.0. There is unprecedented growth that is happening in the user-generated space in the Health 2.0 space, and it is creating a shift of paradigm from universities and hospitals doing research versus patients creating their own outcome research. And that is very, very important and will be very relevant for the patient population. So I just wanted to focus people's attention to how good Web 2.0 has helped, is helping, and will help the healthcare space. I am launching a company, HealDeal, which is also in the Health 2.0 application, and it will focus on providing services and access to uninsured patients. So I really need to commend the Web 2.0 revolution that is coming to the Health 2.0 space.
Well, it's certainly not just hype to you, huh?
Absolutely, it is. It is great because people are letting go of all this, you know, privacy scare. Patients themselves are letting go of HIPAA regulations and sharing their medical information, and that is helping the physicians to make decisions based on the outcome data that they are producing themselves. It is great, and I really would like, you know, our speakers to comment some on this.
Sure. I mean, we've been talking about digitizing healthcare records for probably the better part of a decade, and I mean, the opportunity is great. What, a doctor refers you to a specialist, and instead of kind of, you know, dragging the folder with you and having to explain anew the problem to the specialist, you know, those files are digitally transferred.
That big controversy, actually scandal would be more the appropriate word, with outsourcing and medical data getting in the hands of some people who perhaps were not all that willing to be cooperative, even suggesting perhaps extortion in terms of private information?
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, there's, of course, you know, a risk that goes along with it. You know, there's nothing more private than our health records, and you don't want those to get into the wrong hands or, you know, to be sold to insurance companies who may deny coverage or, you know, expand your premium because of what they find. But, you know, again, there's compromises in all this stuff.
I want to thank Oshana for the call. Go to some more of your emails. Would you ask your guests what, this is from Martin in Palo Alto, what the impact in the long run of the U.S. having a much lower bandwidth to the home than other countries?
Well, yeah, no, the U.S., you know, we trail. We have, I think, it's slightly more than half of our internet users today are broadband connected, and that number is much higher in Europe and in parts of Asia. And, I mean, remarkably, you know, the U.S. continues to be the center of innovation. But, I mean, you know, over the long term, you have to wonder, with so much more bandwidth overseas, whether, you know, the developers and entrepreneurs there don't, you know, start to figure out new ways to take advantage of that connectivity. You know, and like a lot of the new services we're seeing now, you know, internet video and kind of two-way face-to-face, you know, web chats. It's moving more slowly here because we are kind of, you know, more limited in bandwidth, and our phone companies and our cable companies are moving a little bit slower.
Here's another danger signal from a listener named Steve in San Jose, who says, One of your guests mentioned that everything is moving to the web and away from the desktop. One way to look at that is we're moving our life's work out of our own pockets into the equivalent of a bank. But these banks are like the pre-1930s Depression banks that have very little regulation or insurance against their disappearance. What happens when you put all your home movies, photos, or diary entries on another company's service, and to some degree, they own it? They can take it with them when they fold. Poof, I've lost a major slice of my life's work. What insurance is there against this kind of loss?
Well, that's why you back everything up. I mean, you know, I think that that's a very fair point. And I think people need to realize what they're getting into. And, you know, as Brad said earlier, like, you know, no one's forcing anyone to use these services. They're there if you want to, you know, play around with them, if you want to have a more efficient way to be connected with people, if you want to be able to kind of go from your laptop to your desktop and have all your media not tethered to a computer. I think, you know, it's, you know, I don't know about you guys, but like I've had several iPods now, and every time they crash, I have to reload them with all my music again when I get the next one. So I've got, you know, I didn't throw away all my CDs. But I think it's important to back everything up, because these are really personal things. Photos, videos, these are not, you know, commodities in the same way of, you know, my Quicken, you know, crashed and I've got to reboot my, you know, my bills for the month or something like that.
I think that the subpoena risk is one of the big ones. I mean, let's say you have a falling out with your business partner, you know, and it turns into litigation. They can go and subpoena, you know, the internet company where you've hosted all your email and all your documents. And so you are losing control, and it's a two-way street. You know, I wrote a story a couple of weeks ago about how divorces and divorce cases are now just infused with kind of digital snooping, because you don't have to just overhear the phone calls. You can go and read the emails and subpoena the internet companies and get all the information you need to bury your former partner in court.
Oh,
that's a much bigger risk.
Indeed. A new world. Let me go to a couple more emails before I go to more calls. This is Patrice, who says, great program, and in the early days of web use, there seemed to be more availability of browsers. Example, Netscape, Firefox. Today, it seems people only write for Explorer. With Web 2.0, is Safari going to make it as a player or go the way of Netscape? As a Mac user, I sure feel at the short end of the stick, often unable to take advantage of website features and sometimes unable to use them at all. When I contact the offerer, I've been told many times that the site is not designed for use by Safari.
Well, she left out Firefox.
Yeah, switched to Firefox. Yeah, yeah. I mean,
that's what I was going
to
say.
I think what's amazing about Firefox is the testament to sort of this community thing, which is the same thing we're talking about with these sites. Firefox was this tiny, tiny sort of nonprofit group that was sort of abandoned and spun out of AOL that actually used the old Netscape code, put out a browser about the same time, you know, Apple put out Safari. I mean, who's sort of more powerful and cool now than Apple and tech? And because Firefox had this grassroots community thing, you know, all these people who felt very strongly there needed to be a new browser, you know, they started really getting out and pushing Firefox. These college kids made a big crop circle of the Firefox logo. Everyone, all these people chipped in for a full double page in the New York Times. I mean, everyone sort of got behind pushing this and getting it momentum.
I found out about Firefox from my daughter. I mean, it's
probably
natural.
You have college kids handing out leaflets. So, you know, I think there's actually been a lot of momentum with Firefox. I think it's something that's been, you know, a testament of how, where the web is going, that individual people made this a success, where Apple couldn't really do the same thing with Safari.
One more email. Dan in San Jose writes, I met my wife in 1996 on a site that was called World Chat. It's now worlds.com, and it was a virtual chat room where you essentially benefited from video game technology and entered a 3D world, picked an avatar to represent you, and then connected with others. I think that this is where things are headed in the near future, to a place where we have 3D spaces, stores, commerce, advertising, and a fully interactive world. Think about the prevalence of WoW, World of Warcraft, and massive multiplayer online experiences. Why aren't you discussing this? By the way, I met my wife in 96. She was in Sweden. I was in San Jose. I didn't even have an email account of my own yet at the time, talking about things being ahead of their time.
Well, sir, I mean, there are companies making bets on that to happen. I mean, there's a service called Second Life where you go and you assume an avatar and you play around in a 3D world. And there are reports that Google, with its like very cool Google Earth application, a sort of kind of replica and increasingly a 3D replica of the real world, is ultimately moving in that direction, letting people sort of assume a character and roam around in that world. But we're a little bit ahead of that right now.
Yeah, I'm actually really skeptical about virtual worlds. I think it's a certain group of people who want to do it. That's having said, I'm sure it's a big business, but I am not convinced it's a mass play.
Well, let's hear from Keith next. Keith, thanks for waiting. You're on the air with us. Good morning.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Sure. I'd like to know if in Web 2.0, are we going to see the development of other business models besides advertising? I'm really getting tired of all these free services that really depend on them making income from some other thing like selling my information or making me buy so many prints. I just would like to have a traditional business relationship where I pay a company for services, they do what I want. Right now with companies like Google, I'm not actually a customer, I'm actually their product.
I think that's a great point. And I think the pendulum has swung so far back to ad businesses, which, you know, in the years right after the bust was, you know, just seemed insane. And I think it's really going to start coming back to paid subscriptions soon. I think, you know, when we talk about social networks, people forget LinkedIn, which is the third largest one and is actually profitable and has made its money primarily not through advertising, but fee-based services. I mean, you can send someone a direct mail message through LinkedIn, or you can help, you know, you can find a job through LinkedIn, through your contacts. They've done a great job of actually having sort of premium services you pay for on the site. And I think I do think it's a model that companies haven't been focused on, but I think in the next year or so, that's going to come back.
Yeah, I think the one constant about the ad business is that it's cyclical. And during the next recession, when every major advertiser packs it in, we're going to see some companies trying to find new ways to make money.
So we're coming to the end of the program here. I'm not going to make either of you into visionaries or soothsayers here, but Web 2.0, it's here pretty much, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it's here, and there's some exciting stuff. But
what's most exciting to you?
The opportunity to participate and for just regular people and internet users to express themselves and to share, you know, and to be artists and to be journalists we're just getting access to
a
so
world
many
of
different
amateurs,
voices.
As somebody once said, right? Welcome to the world of amateurism.
Yeah, it's not necessarily the best thing for us in the ivory media tower, but I mean, you know, just the amount and the variety of content out there is just it is really exciting. I mean, the value of it's questionable. Does a major advertiser want to put its brand next to somebody dancing in their basement? I don't think we quite know the answer to that yet, or maybe the answer is no. But I mean, certainly, the variety of cool stuff on the internet right now is exciting.
Right. Sarah Lacey, final word.
You know, I think what is fascinating about this wave, if you look across all the different kind of companies, it's all about kind of tapping into these human needs we're all prey to, whether it's ego boosting of someone watching your YouTube video or reading your blog, whether it's, you know, connecting with someone, whether it's meeting someone online, you know, no matter what it is, or entertainment. There's such a human tie with these sites that there wasn't really would say, I mean, buying anything you want on Amazon's awesome, but it doesn't have that human pull. I don't know if it translates to a business, but it's socially exciting.
Sarah Lacey of Business Week, Brad Stone of New York Times, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Forum, and our producers are Robin Giannatasio Ma and Kevin Guillory. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Let's thank our interns, Gladys Diandoki, Jesse Finfrock, Marco Bell, Ingalisa Schrabsdorf, Karen Song, and June Stinson. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.